lever that is, I think, could be most impactful if pulled is if social impact bonds were driven more by technical intermediaries. Because it's only really organizations that have deep expertise in the underlying outcomes and working at an ecosystem level who I think are best placed to determine whether a social impact bond would be appropriate, and if so, how it should be best structured.
This is Mission to Scale, a podcast that reveals the tools, mindsets, and strategies that organizations and funders need to maximize their impact, because the world's biggest problems need solutions at scale. I'm your host, Dan Berelovitz, founder of Spring Impact. Today, we're diving into the fascinating and quite complex world of social impact bonds. Social impact bonds are a financing mechanism in which governments or donors pay social service providers and investors for the delivery of predefined outcomes. The key is that the service providers only get paid if the project goes well, so there's an incentive for excellent delivery. Lerato Lehoko is the former managing director of Bonds for Jobs, a financial intermediary that implemented the first social impact bond in South Africa. In today's episode, Lerato explains how the private investment group Yellowwoods and the non-profit Harambee Youth Employment Accelerator successfully set up the Inclusive Youth Employment Bond. We talk about how this bond is helping inclusive youth employment in South Africa and about the potential of social impact bonds more generally. Lastly, Lerato gives her advice for leaders in the social sector wishing to set up a social impact bond themselves. Lerato started her career in the financial services industry, eventually landing a job at Yellowwoods and focusing her work on financial inclusion. You might be familiar with Yellowwoods from our previous episode with Nicola Golombek, the executive director of the same organization.
So Yellowwoods is a privately held global investment firm. Our portfolio consists of what we call finance first organizations, mainly in financial services, restaurant, and leisure businesses. We also have a sizable portfolio of impact first entities that Yellowwoods has founded, incubated, and as they grow, Yellowwoods continues to support those social enterprises with financial and leadership capital. So the model in Yellowwoods has been to always deploy its people into these social enterprises at different moments of their journeys to drive whatever strategic imperative those organizations have at the time. So it is from Yellowwoods that I have done all the work in financial inclusion in the financial services businesses. It was from Yellowwoods that I worked with Harambee, a Yellowwoods social enterprise, on the bond on youth employment. And it is from Yellowwoods that I am now deployed into Imbe to be the MD, because Imbe is another one of Yellowwoods' founded social enterprises.
Before becoming the managing director of Imbe, an enterprise incubator for businesses in the early childhood development sector in South Africa, Lerato managed Bonds for Jobs. As mentioned before, Bonds for Jobs is a financial intermediary of the Inclusive Youth Employment Bond, which was incubated by Yellowwoods and Harambee Youth Employment Accelerator. Harambee is an award-winning nonprofit that connects employers to low-income first-time job seekers in an effort to address the unemployment crisis in South Africa. We talked about Harambee last season in our episode with Anne May Chang. If you want to go back and check that out, you'll find the link in our show notes. For those who might not be familiar with social impact bonds, could you maybe share a bit about what they are?
So a social impact bond is a financing arrangement that enables a payer of a social service. So think of a government or a donor who would be paying for social programs to be delivered. Typically what you have is the payer would be funding inputs. So to use our example of youth employment, we have a government or a donor paying for training. As young people are trained, the donor pays. The challenge with that is when that training does not convert into the young person finding a job, the donor or the payer has no recourse. So what the social impact bond will do is it allows the payer of the social service to pay only when predefined outcomes are met. So in our case, a government would say, I will pay you a fixed amount of money for every young person that transitions into a job. So that's the first step and the most important one, because as you can imagine, once you pay on outcomes, the return on that spend is improved. Then the question that naturally arises is, if the payer is paying at the end, who's going to provide the working capital to deliver those services in the first place? And the answer to that question depends on the nature of the service providers. Some service providers, such as private companies, can raise their own working capital. And then you have a standard pay-for-performance funding agreement. But in most instances, the service providers that deliver these social services themselves can't raise their own working capital because they are social enterprises or not-for-profits. And that's when investors or, you know, providers of risk capital are introduced into the transaction, because then they provide the upfront working capital to the service provider, and they then take on the performance risk of that service provider because they will be repaid by the payer only to the extent that the service provider has delivered on the outcomes. So that is the basic construct of a social impact bond. You have an investor or a risk taker that provides the upfront working capital to deliver a social service, and a payer or an outcomes funder that pays back the investor only to the extent that outcomes are delivered. And just for some jargon, in the market, it's called a social impact bond if the payer is a government, and a development impact bond if the payer is a donor. In our case, we had both government and donors as payers, as outcomes funders.
Fantastic. So it sounds like just getting this all set up could have been quite complex. Have these been done before successfully in Africa and indeed in any other parts of the world? Were you able to draw from experience from others?
Yes. So when we implemented our bond, I think it had been just over a decade since the first social impact bond had been launched in the UK, actually. And there were, I think, over 100 that had been launched since then. There's been quite a lot more activity since then. So whilst, you know, compared to other parts of financial markets, it does remain a nascent space. Very few bonds can be implemented off any blueprint. So they remain, you know, first of a kind in many respects. The market is developing. Our bond was the first impact bond to be launched in South Africa, and yet our financial markets are so deep. So yes, it's a growing field, but there's more to be done.
Why did you decide to step out and be the first then to do this? What are the benefits that you saw in social impact bonds, development impact bonds?
Sure. And that's an important question, because it is not an instrument that is relevant or suitable for all contexts and challenges. So just to step back on the context that we were facing at the time, as I said, we implemented the bond with Harambee, Youth Employment Accelerator. I think Harambee had been operating for six 6 to 7 years at that time, seeking to address the youth unemployment challenge in South Africa in many ways. And one of the factors that stood out to both Harambee and Yellow Woods at the time was that South Africa was unique to other African countries in a way, in that we had and continue to have quite significant amounts of public spent on the post-school and education system. And yet we sat with one of the highest youth unemployment rates. So large amounts of money not yielding the results that are intended. And that's when we started the thinking around what are the instruments that improve the return on existing spend? Is there a way for us to change the conditionality of the existing funding spend in skills so that that spend has an improved conversion? Because we've got a lot of learning and very low conversion of learning to earning.
As Lerato notes, billions of dollars were spent annually towards traditional education pathways in South Africa, and yet unemployment rates were high. By 2017, Harambee had demonstrated the success of their model by quickly and effectively training nearly 100,000 young people outside of university to acquire the skills to get a job. Yet the public and private skilling system in South Africa had not changed. The Yellow Woods team began designing Bonds for Jobs as an ideal way to promote a focus on outcomes, and in Lerato's words, increase the conversion from learning to earning.
That was our context, and I think it's so important because our objective was to influence the conditionality of existing public spend in skilling. Just that, right? So our modality, when we seek to influence public spend, is to demonstrate quite credibly and robustly what we would like the government to replicate or adopt. So, you know, our pilot was to achieve a demonstration effect. So we knew that the part of government that we wanted to influence was the Department of Higher Education and Training. We had existing partnerships with the Gauteng provincial government and the National Treasury, and we approached them to experiment with us on this so that, you know, as two credible parts of government, would create this demonstration effect with us for the Department of Higher Education and Training. And that's what we did. We created a bond where the payers were Gauteng provincial government, the jobs fund in the National Treasury, and we had some donors, including Yellow Woods, First Rand Empowerment Foundation, and others. And then Harambee, with its existing assets and capabilities on the subject matter, played the role of a technical intermediary, and they managed the performance. So whilst Bonds for Jobs was a financial intermediary, Harambee played the role of a technical intermediary. And then on the outcomes, we targeted three job families in South Africa that our market intelligence had indicated to us that these were areas of growth and where there was skill scarcity. And, you know, our payers only paid when the young people were in a job. And we managed it that way. So that was the bond. As you say, the bond wound down. But it's really, really exciting for us that the Department of Higher Education and Training is indeed replicating this model. So at the beginning of the year, they released a request for proposal for service providers and technical intermediaries. So we're quite excited that we did indeed achieve our demonstration effect. The right parts of government have taken note of this model. They are on their own journey to experiment and see how they can take it on.
Wow, congratulations. That's good, which is no mean feat given you had COVID, which was, a problem for the program at the end of it and, you know, has provided a break as well. Can I just clarify how the program works? Because it is quite complex. all the different components and players and parts. So Harambe, you said, are the technical intermediary. Were they actually the ones doing the training, or were they working with other organizations to coach them in training these young people?
So both, right? In one aspect, they were doing the training. In another aspect, they were managing other organizations that were doing the training. And I think that is important for social impact bonds broadly, in that there are many financial intermediaries in the world, but very few technical intermediaries with expertise in the outcomes, right? So we had Harambe at the time. As I said, they had developed quite deep expertise in working with excluded young people, because our rate card compelled the service providers to work with young people who were excluded from the economy and not just cream at the surface and just push through candidates who didn't even need the intervention, right? So we had quite robust measures to ensure that service providers worked with the most deserving candidates. So that actually gives the investors, the providers of risk capital, more comfort when you have a technical intermediary that has expertise in the actual outcome. Because as you can imagine, investors will do their own due diligence and assess the risk that they're taking on, which is the likelihood of achieving outcomes. And what we could put forward there was Harambe's track record.
Hey, Mission to Scale listeners, I need a favor. If the show has helped you in any way, can you share this episode with a friend or colleague? Maybe it's someone who likes listening to good podcasts in their downtime or on their way to work. All you have to do is copy the link in this episode and send it over with a, "Hey, you might want to check out Mission to Scale." To keep providing the show, we need to build our audience. And if you haven't yet, please subscribe where you listen to your podcasts. Appreciate you for helping spread the word. And thank you for being part of the Mission to Scale community. Now back to the show. You mentioned this concept of creaming, which I think is a regular criticism of impact bonds, which my understanding is essentially because you're being paid on someone getting into work, there's a strong incentive by everyone in the system to pick people who are as close to being able to get a job on their own without any training as possible. But really, that's not what we're after here. We're after training up people who really don't have access to the job markets already, maybe come from a background of poverty. So you said that there were some measures that you put in place to ensure that creaming didn't happen, and you really went genuinely for the people who needed this service. Can you talk a bit more about that?
Sure. I think everyone is aware that measures and indicators of poverty are not as black and white as we would like them to be. But we really relied on indicators that Harambe had developed over time to indicate the level of social and economic exclusion that young people face, right? So some of the indicators include whether the young person received a government support grant, right? Whether they come from households that are dependent on government grants. In South Africa, quintile 1, 2, and 3 schools don't pay school fees. So a young person who's attended a school in one of those quintiles would be regarded as excluded from the economy. So it was a composite indicator of a few factors that contextually in South Africa indicate exclusion, both social and economic. Getting a young person who's coming from a poor household into a job, we just know theoretically that that is transformative, not only for the young person, but for their household, right? To come from a family that was grant dependent, for you to have a stable salary is very transformational. The, you know, immediate level of financial security that it provides for your household. These are young people who would be coming from multi-generational households, living with a gran or other siblings and parents. And it just provided a level of cushioning financially that these families wouldn't have had up until now, right? And then we have success stories, right? Because these young people are hungry for success and they work hard and they get promoted and some of them are able to buy their families homes and to, you know, just really take a different trajectory for their families. 40% of them are parents themselves. So their children would typically be not accessing ECD, right? And when the young person gets employed, then suddenly they can provide quality early childhood development for their own children.
This podcast is all about scale. It does feel like there's a potentially scalable solution in there. What's your sort of vision for where this could go in the next 5, 10, or even 20 years?
Large amounts of public spend on skilling. I think the last time we got numbers on this, we're looking at over 200 billion rand that is spent on skilling. And that's across the PSET system. So some of it goes to universities, some of it goes to colleges. But I think in the growing space of non-accredited, demand-driven skills, you know, if this model could be applied, you know, for the entire bucket of spend there, I think that would be a great win for us because we're talking about programs such as coding boot camps, right? That can get a young person into a software development role in 2 years versus a 4-year university degree, right? Data analytics, installation repairs and maintenance, which are your artisanal roles, international business process outsourcing. You know, those are areas of high growth in South Africa. They don't need formal, expensive tertiary qualifications. So they are shorter, they are cheaper. If that bucket of spend in government can grow, and if it can be all spent on a pay for results basis, I think that will be a huge win for us.
That's interesting in terms of innovation versus scaling up what works already. I know one of the sort of critiques of social impact bonds and having these very definite outcomes is that I think the initial idea was we innovate, it's encouraging the sort of actors who are actually delivering the training to try new things. But I think in reality, if you're being held to account on outcomes, that's probably not the time you want to innovate and try new things. So could you talk a bit about innovation versus scaling what works and whether the system you're talking about, where it's all very outcome focused, will allow for innovation? Or is it really just about government funding scaling up what works then?
I think you need to have established your credibility to even qualify, right? So what have you done to date? You've innovated, you've earned your stripes, right? Now we can trust you that you can innovate and you can innovate well. And that makes you eligible. Then I think innovation is a continuum, right? So are you going to be able to fundamentally change your program during the implementation of a social impact bond? I'm not sure. But are you going to be able to make tweaks and changes as, you know, you implement and you get feedback loops? Absolutely. I think that's very possible in an impact bond because you're not held to your operational plan. You're held to an outcome. So I think it's different levels of innovation that are enabled. And then obviously, social impact bonds aren't long-term contracts, right? So you can implement a certain model, make a few tweaks and changes during that phase of implementation, you learn a lot. In the next phase, you can implement more transformative or radical innovative changes, right? So I think the idea is to strike the balance between, you know, flexibility, continuous improvement, and tweaks and changes while delivering results and sort of earning and keeping your license to play, right?
Lastly, Lerata gives her advice to governments or organizations who might want to implement this model.
I think there's a decision tree that was shared by the Brookings Institute a while ago that just shows sort of decision framework to determine whether a social impact bond is relevant in the first place for the challenge you are trying to solve. I cannot emphasize that enough. I think I said this earlier, social impact bonds are certainly not suitable and applicable across the board. They're not a panacea. So, you know, I think the decision tree starts with assessing whether paying for outcomes would increase the return on that spend, would improve results. If yes, then can the service providers provide their own working capital? Because if they can, you don't need a social impact bond. You can just do a straightforward pay for results contract, right? It's only if service providers can't provide their own working capital, you need to go down the route of setting up a bond, of raising risk capital, right? And I think just the discipline of going through that decision tree before you, you know, go too far would save a lot of people, consultant monies and time. So if it is the right instrument, I think it's, you know, it's a great lever of change.
And so, talking of great levers of change, what do you think the future of social impact bonds looks like then?
For me, I think the lever that is, I think could be most impactful if pulled is if social impact bonds were driven more by technical intermediaries rather than financial intermediaries or, you know, consultants. Because it's only really organizations that have deep expertise in the underlying outcomes and working at an ecosystem level, you know, really understanding the ecosystem, the players, the incentives, who I think are best placed to determine whether a social impact bond would be appropriate. And if so, how it should be best structured.
Today's conversation really helped me to reflect on the potential of social impact bonds to enable replication and scaling. I was happy to hear that this model was effective in South Africa. I do have some concerns with the impact bond model, that it can be overly complex and expensive to administer and deliver. But I applaud the people working on bonds because I believe that with some tweaking, innovative finance solutions that work at scale will come from it. And as Lerato says, if you've been inspired to embark upon creating your own bond, it's essential to first do a proper assessment to determine if it's right for your goals. If you want to learn more about Harambee Youth Employment Accelerator, visit harambee.co.za. Link is in our show notes. That's it for today's episode. Please don't forget to subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss out on any of our episodes. And while you're there, I'd appreciate it if you could rate and give us a review. If you love Mission to Scale, I hope you recommend our show to a friend or colleague. Thanks so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. If you've enjoyed this episode of Mission to Scale, check out Upstarts, a new podcast series by The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. Upstarts focuses on the stories of a diverse range of impact entrepreneurs spanning industries, interests, and influence. The series gets to the heart of the journey of an impact entrepreneur, looking into how they built their companies, what problems they're trying to fix, their impact so far, and their hopes for the future. What can we learn and action from their experience? Thank you to our media partner, Alliance Magazine. If you'd like to stay connected with the latest news in global philanthropy, Mission to Scale listeners can get a 50% off your first subscription by using the code SPRINGIMPACT at checkout. Visit alliancemagazine.org to find out more. Mission to Scale is produced by Spring Impact and Human Group Media. If you want to learn more about our work at Spring Impact, visit springimpact.org and follow us at Spring Impact on Twitter.